We are starting Perek Chet. Very exciting. Starting chapter 8. Chapter 7 took us a good long time, but with reason. There was Pesach in the middle. Aside from that, it took us a while because we had to introduce Ezra. I'm not going to, again, go through all the things that we said regarding Ezra. But it really is remarkable that he shows up so late and that people's impression is that he's there from the beginning. I just edited an article for somebody today who had written about the... What he said was, Ezra told the Samaritans, it's not for you and for us to build the temple together. But we now know, because we read chapter 4, that wasn't Ezra at all. Ezra was still in Babel, in Babylon, and it wasn't him. But that's just, that's the way people talk, as though Ezra is the one who leads the Aliyah, and no, he shows up late. He's there after they complete building the Beis HaMikdash, after they finish building the temple. And last week, we read Artaxasta's decree, the royal decree, which empowers Ezra to do basically whatever he wants, right? He's given great wealth to bring for the needs of the temple in its early stages and for the ongoing needs as well, licensed to be able to take the temple's ongoing needs from the local tax collection. He's also given the ability to judge cases as he sees fit and to punish people as he sees fit. Anything he wants, basically, is given to him. And what we're going to see now in Perek Chet, in chapter 8, you see the outline of it on the sheet, is after the end of the chapter in which Ezra offers his thanks to God, we're going to get this list of names of people who joined Ezra on his journey. We're going to see the problem of populating the Beit HaMikdash. Ezra's going to discover that he has a shortfall in one population which he needs, and we'll see how he deals with that. Then we get his prayer when they're ready to set out. He assigns the gifts that they're bringing to the Kohanim and Levim to bring to the Beis HaMikdash, to bring to the temple, and then the journey itself, which we're not going to get to. So we won't finish the chapter this week, but I do expect to move relatively quickly through it because, again, we've laid a lot of the groundwork that will take us through this. So we start with a name list. Just like we had back in chapter 2 with the original journey, we now get a list of who comes with Ezra. And our question has to be, why are you going to give me a list of names? Who needs a list of names like this? So first let's look at the list, and then we'll have to ask the question of what it's doing here. What is its purpose? Chapter 8, sentence 1, if you're using the stone Tanakh, is page 1831. Looking at those names, if you try to read some of those in the English, you're really better off in the Hebrew. All right, fine. Here are the heads of the families. Here is their yichus, their association, right? We usually render yichus as some form of lineage, although really it's a broad term. It doesn't mean biological lineage per se. It means association nonetheless. These are the heads of the families and their associations. Ha'olim imi, v'malchus Artaxaste ha'melech mi'bavel. Those who came with me in the reign of Artaxaste the king, from Babel. Notice that he mentions his sponsor. Right? In other words, it isn't those who came with me from Babel, the ones who came with me in the reign of this king, because, as we noted last time, Artaxaste is generous. Artaxaste is very helpful. He's still the king, and you're still a citizen of his. And so you had better make sure that you give credit where credit is due, and mention the king in this. So here's the list of those who came with me. Remember, Ezra speaks first person when he takes over the book. Mibnei Finchas Gershom. Mibnei Isamar Daniel. Mibnei David Chatush. These are names of that ring a bell here, right? The names Pinchas, Itamar, David, these ring a bell. It doesn't mean that these are descendants of the famous ones who we know from Tanakh, but those names certainly do recur in and among the Jewish people. So we get some pretty familiar names in the bunch. Pinchas, Itamar, David, Daniel for that matter, Gershom for that matter, these are also Jewish names. Chatush is the only one that you look at it and kind of scratch your head. Where'd that one come from? Why isn't that a popular name? Why doesn't anyone name their kid Chatush? I can't imagine why. Yes. Absolutely. We have to tell people there's a school. You name your kid Chatush. It's good for something. Okay.
The kid in the class with that name.
What?
That would be the only kid in the class with that name.
Yes, indeed. Mibnei Shechaniah, Mibnei Parosh, Zechariah, V'imo, Hisyaches, from the descendants of Shechaniah, from the descendants of Parosh, Zechariah. The way Rashi reads this line is that it's one family. The sons of Shechaniah, the sons of Parosh, Zechariah is the head of the family, V'imo Hisyaches Lizcharim Me'ava Chamishim, and with them 150 males. The Ibn Ezra Metzudat David say that's not the way to read the line, rather it's from the descendants of Shechaniah, who is from Parosh. And the reason why the text needs to do that is because in sentence 5 we're going to have a different Shechaniah. So these are the Shechaniah who's from Parosh, and these are the Shechaniah who's from Yachziel. Julie.
One question I have is, I get Ezra is made these lists of lineages because that was part of his job, clarifying lineages. So I get, okay, it had to be written down, it had to be published at some point, but how is this relevant to 2,000 years later?
Right.
I don't
so,
know any
right.
People.
Good. Well, that's your fault. But but we're going to go through the list first and then ask exactly that question. So hold the thought and keep thinking about it, because we have quite a few more names. And then once we get through the names, then we're going to come back to exactly that point. Why is this here? And not just why does Ezra do it, but indeed, why is it in Tanakh? Why did the Great Assembly feel like we needed to know this? So first, though, we have to read about them. By the way, just Parosh in this line. So we had a Parosh in the first list, in chapter 2. We had Parosh, and we thought it was funny, because Parosh is what? Anybody remember? A flea or a louse, right. So we thought that was an interesting name to give somebody. We did note, though, that many biblical names are associated with creatures you would normally think you wouldn't want to be named for. Devorah is a bee. Huldah is a... some kind of a rodent, some kind of a digging rodent. And the Gemara actually asks about those names, other things to learn. Sorry?
Chaya Mushka is a very popular name.
Okay, what does that mean? I mean, Chaya, no, Mushka is a fly. I didn't know that. Okay. So yet another one. The Dan Mikra edition notes back in chapter 2 that names like this were also found in non-Jewish Semitic cultures. So in other words, it's not just us using names like this. This was just not considered a bad thing. I think today, if you named your kid that, you know, there might be issues. But but in those days, they didn't take it personally, or maybe they said, you know, there's a lot we can learn from all creatures, and therefore it's okay to name me Louse. You know, that's just fine. They're very tenacious. It's a tenacious creature. That's the bracha that the rabbi gave at the bris when they named the kid Parosh. Is that, you know, lice are tenacious. Okay. The Pasuk Dalet, sentence 4. Oh, by the way, the other element that's introduced here is, what else is new in sentence 3 that we didn't see in the names in sentence 2? Numbers. Right? Suddenly we start to get numbers where we didn't get in the in Pasuk Bet in sentence 2. And no one I've seen has had a good explanation for why it is that the first batch doesn't, you know, the ones in Pasuk Bet do not get numbers. The Dot Mikra edition thinks that the ones in Pasuk Bet are Kohanim and the rest are not Kohanim, but that doesn't explain why you won't have numbers there. It's simply just, you know, they're not there.
Suddenly we're saying that there's Harim where everywhere else is just assumed.
It's just assumed that these are going to be the males. Well, no, there are fewer, it says Harim. It's no, only the opening one that it doesn't.
No, I understand. But in this paragraph, which we didn't have in the previous, I believe...
You mean back in Perek Bet?
Yeah.
Well, in Perek Bet, we actually debated... In Perek Bet, we actually debated that question. And I think our conclusion, if I remember correctly, in chapter 2, was that list was not male-specific. Mm-hmm. When it numbered them, like, that was it. Those were your families. Whereas here, it is assumed to be just the males, which is why we also did last time the multiplier. And we said that the assumption is, although we didn't know why, that there were 5 per family. And since the number is going to be about 1,800, so that means there are 9,000 people coming with Ezra. Whereas in the previous list, in chapter 2, we assumed, no, this is all family members included, because it did not say... Zicharim. Okay. Mibnei, Pasuk Dalet, sentence 4. Mibnei, Pachas Moav, and this is one of those names you don't want to read in English. El Yahoeinai, Ben Zerachia, V'imah Masayim HaZecharim, from the children of Pachas Moav. Pachas Moav was another name that showed up as a family name back in chapter 2. And we said then the literal meaning of Pachas Moav means ruler of Moav. But why does that make any sense as the name for, you know, a Jewish family? So we said then that the Gemara in Tanis, which I think I brought you on your sheet in source number 2, says it doesn't mean the ruler of Moav, rather means the ruler who came from Moav is what we're talking about, or the conqueror of Moav. But we gave in source number 2 in the Gemara in Tanis, either this means sons of David, right, King David, because he descended from Moav, or alternatively, it's Yoav ben Tsruya, who's also a descendant of Rus and Moav. He's part of the family. So that may be what we mean when we say Pachas Moav, the ruler who is from Moav, rather than the ruler of Moav. This is a great name, El Yehoenai. Can you parse that one? Can you figure out what that means?
God is my eyes.
Maybe. That mikra suggests that El here is El, as in two. So, to God are my eyes. My eyes are to God. That's the idea. Shana?
Maybe Ayin as in spring.
Ayin as in spring. To God are my springs.
No, God is my spring.
Oh, God is my spring. Well, then what we do with the Aleph Lamed in the beginning? You would take that as name of God. But then what's the Yeho? Unless you're using two names of God in the name. Right. Assuming I read it that way, then yeah. Could be. It's a certain name you can do pretty much anything with. It sounds like it would fit well in Hawaii.
It looks like it would get touched in Israel today.
Yeah, that could be.
Yes.
Okay. The whole bunch of names we have to recover here. Mibnei, Pasuk Hey, we get the other Shechania. Mibnei Shechania ben Yachaziel. V'imo shlosh meos hazicharim. You get another 300 men with Shechania ben Yachaziel. Okay, there's another name that we know, Shechania ben Yechiel. So it's interesting to wonder whether there's some kind of a blending here. But okay, Mibnei Adin Eved ben Yonasan, and from Adin you have Eved ben Yonasan, and yes, his name is Eved. The imo chamishim hazacharim, and with him you get 50 males. We've seen that name Eved show up elsewhere. Remember in Shoftim you have Gal ben Eved. So again, it seems like a strange name to use, Eved meaning slave, but roll with the punches. The
pasuk.
Yeah.
What would your reference?
I don't know. Yeah.
Are these references to the father of these individuals or to their ancestors?
So it seems that what we're getting here is the name of the family, Mibnei so-and-so, and then the person who's considered the leader of those who came. So in this case, Eved. So Mibnei Adin, from the Adin family, Eved bin Yonasan, who has with him 50 males.
So we're saying his father was...
Well, his father's Yonasan.
Not that he's from Saul's son.
Correct. I don't think in any of these cases are we meant to read back that way. Except possibly this Pachas Moav thing. That could be, I guess. Yeah?
I mean, if it was children of David, it would be David. It would be, they'd come from that lineage. Why would they be so obtuse?
What do you mean? You mean to say Pachas Moav?
Yes.
In other words, why wouldn't they have just said David? Probably because other people were named David. Like the one who was Bnei David Chatush.
Yeah, but if that's your lineage, most people are proud of that lineage when they come from the lineage of David.
So you would say David HaMelech, or you would say something like that.
Something, I don't know. I think
it's an interesting point. The problem is that we're working with something that is fundamentally problematic, because Pachas Moav can't mean ruler of Moav. Mm-hmm. So what am I going to do? You're right, naming David ruler from Moav is imaginative. But why would you do that?
And exactly, why would you do that? Because that wasn't of all the things to of all the identifying factors. Why would you choose that?
Right, it's a legitimate question. It's a legitimate question, unless you're going to say that that's the rationale for saying it's Yoav rather than saying it's David. Because once you bring in Yoav, you get into some very problematic figures in terms of some of the back and forth that went on among David's generals. But saying Pachas Moav really doesn't help you in that regard. So I don't know. It's a good point. The Pasuk Zayin, sentence 7, Umi b'nei Elam, and from the sons of Elam, Elam here has to be a name of an individual, not the nation Elam, Yeshaya ben Asalia, v'imau shibim azcharim, Yeshaya son of Asalia. Presumably this is not Atalia, the queen, the killer queen. That's not who we're talking about. But he goes in with 70 people, 70 males. Ubnei Shephatiah Zevadia ben Michael, v'imo shmonim hazacharim. We're in sentence 8. Shephatiah's family, Zevadia ben Michael, Zebediah, as he may be known. And then you get Ubnei Yoav. So here's somebody who actually is named Yoav. And here the Gemara in Bava Basra actually thinks this is Yoav the general that we're actually talking about, so it disagrees with that view clearly from Tanis. But Ibnei Yoav, Ovadia ben Yechiel, V'imo Masayim Ushmona Asar Hazicharim. He's an overachiever, 218 males. Ibnei Shlomit ben Yosifya, Shlomit as a man's name. V'imo Mea V'shishim Hazicharim, another 160 males through that. And then Ibnei Vevai, Zechariah ben Bevai, V'imal esim ushmona azacharim. Zechariah was the son of Bevai, along with 28 males. V'ibnei Azgad, Yochanan ben Hakatan. Azgad is a good name. Remember, what does God mean in the Torah? Luck, right? Mazel. There's actually a God. There's a deity, you know, among the idols, who's known as God. Harachim la God Shulchan. But here I would use God in the same way that Leah does when she names the kid Ba God. She isn't saying that it's the idol, the deity, but just saying, wow, mazel. The as God, mazel, strong mazel. The Yochanan ben Hakatan. Don't call me shorty. The Imo, Me'ava Asaraz Harim, with 110 males. And then finally, Umibnei Adonikam Acharonim. From the sons of Adonikam, Acharonim, the last. Ve'elash Mosam, and here are their names, Eliphelet, Ye'iel, Ushmaya, Ve'imahem, Shishim, Azacharim, along with 60 males. Why does it call them the last? So Rashi, Mitzudat, David say these are the last to join Ezra. They're the last to sign up, so that's what they're called, Acharonim. In the Midbar, in the wilderness, when they traveled, so the group of Dan is described as Acharonim. They're the last, because they travel last in the formation.
Except they have another group.
Except that what, sorry?
We have another group.
Where? Okay, we have another group coming next.
Right.
So they can't be the last in the formation. They have to be the last to have joined up. Alternatively, Malbim and Dot Mikra suggest these are the last of Adonikam's family. Maybe. Ubnei Vigvai Usai, because we had another group in Adonikam's family in Perek Bet, in chapter 2. So you had a group there who came from Adonikam, and now these are the stragglers from Adonikam. Umibnei Vigvai Usai VeZakur is the way it's read. VeImo Shivim Azacharim, another group with 70 males. That's my group, and then we're going to find out what happened to them. So now we've read a bunch of names. We had some nice comments to make on some of the names, but at the end of the day, What is this doing here? What does it mean to Ezra? What does it mean to the Jews as a whole, you know, post the time of Ezra, such that it needs to make it into Tanakh? So some of the reasons that we gave when we talked about name lists in the first round in Perek Bet are going to apply here as well. Meaning, we gave one explanation that it's poetic style, biblically. We like to include lists of names. It's considered to be poetic, and so that's why it's here. And that would be one approach. Another approach would be that this is Ezra's genealogies, because Ezra, as we've already discussed, feels the need to identify who can marry whom. You come from this exile, who knows what's happened, and therefore it's now been cleaned up, and now you get a proper genealogy for the sake of marriage, as the Gemara in Kiddushin had suggested. Another suggestion that we had made back then was that enumerating all the names make it look like a lot of people showed up. You know, it's very impressive. Although, on the other hand, we noted the opposite trend, which is if I can list everybody, it means that you don't have that many. Right? The different ways to look at it. And some of these people are, to go back again to another explanation we gave in Chapter 2, part of the new nobility. Meaning there are families here who are known as the donors of the wood for the temple, who are known as heads of households, heads of shifts of Kohanim. So therefore they have a special identity. But Rabbi Angel, who I quoted when we did the list the first time, has an idea in source number 1, I don't think it's his own. I think he got it from Tamara Cohn Ashkenazi. That this is also traditional Ezra. This is the sort of thing Ezra will do. He says, turning to the next outstanding figure in Ezra, Nehemiah, we are introduced to Ezra, with a pedigree tracing him back to Aaron. Right? We saw the 15, 16 generations, and a document from Artaxerxes according him substantial authority. Given this remarkable introduction, the reader expects Ezra to dominate the narrative, both as a priest and as a sage. In other words, we just read all about his powers and how wonderful he is. Get moving. Do something, Ezra. But instead, the opposite proves to be the case. The first half of Ezra 8, right after we've given him this great introduction, provides a list of those who returned to Israel along with Ezra. At the conclusion of this roster, Ezra got others involved in bringing the Levites to Israel, which is what's coming next. This sets the tone for Ezra's transferring most of his authority to the people. Ezra is not interested in wielding the power that Artaxerxes has given him. He's much more focused on the nation as a whole and having them be involved and having them lead. Francis, you're going to say? It's much more about what the people are going to do, and therefore, by bringing the names, he's saying it's not just me, it's not about me, it's about this nation that is coming back to the land, which I find to be a nice poetic idea. Whether it's pshat, I don't know. But I think it's a nice idea, and it is consistent with what we know about Ezra and what's going to play out through the book, which is Ezra's not looking for and doesn't do any of the things that we would normally see with the powers of leadership. He doesn't exercise his authority. It's a constant call upon the nation to rise to the task instead. So he says, yes, it's true, here's my lineage and all of that, but here's the nation, and look at all the people who showed up. I guess the one really sort of standout weakness in his approach is the fact that he bothered to bring all 15 generations in the beginning of chapter 7. Right? He's the author of the book. He could have chosen not to include that. Unless you're going to tell me that it's his way of shunting credit to his ancestors. It's not about me. It's all these wonderful people who led to me. So I guess you could do that. Yeah, Sharon.
He's claiming authority from all directions. From the current Artaxerxes or whatever.
Yeah, there you go.
From his own Jewish past.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you need that.
What do you mean?
In order to get the people to feel that they must listen to him, he has to present himself in such a way that he does have authority in all areas.
So there's an element of compromise here. He may not want to wield the authority to force people along, but he does need to establish his credentials.
Yeah, very much so.
I hear that.
These leaders are with him.
Right. Okay. I hear that.
This list seems to differ in tone from the previous list, in the sense that the previous list had a lot to do with people's jobs, where they came from, their forms of employment. Mm-hmm. This one actually reads like a mini version of a list of the census of tribes going through. So many, these are the heads of the group, and these are the numbers that came with them.
Right.
It has a much different feel to it.
Right. It feels less like an official register. I mean, it's very dry, as opposed to the other one.
It sounds very biblical. In the sense,
I'm good with that.
There were 72,000 of the tribe of Shimon, and their leaders were.
Right.
It's reminiscent of the time.
Right. I hear that. I mean, it's not the same as the first list. The first list also has a diversity you don't see here.
Yeah.
It's a much bigger list. And it's a more diverse list. You have the Mamzerim and the Halalim and the this and the that. It's true. You have, not actually Mamzerim aren't in that list. But you have all the different, the Nesinim, you have the servants of Shlomo,
It sounds like they have a group of people that are actually there to work. In the
mm-hmm.
first one. These people are there to travel.
Okay. Could be.
They have occupations.
Right. Not sure. I would like to see. I'd have to really put them side by side and take a closer look to see that. I hear what you're saying. Okay. So, Ezra has his list here of who is with him. He identifies the males, and then we multiply out to try to get to the sum of the population. And now we get to the issue of populating the Beis HaMikdash, populating the temple. Let's see what happens here. Sentences 15 to 20. Look at that. We covered 14 sentences. Just like that.
Is this list in any order?
Not that I could tell. It could be, but I couldn't discern any order here, because we don't know enough about the families. We don't get what tribe they're from. We don't, you know, there's no clear hierarchy, certainly not alphabetical. So I don't know. V'ekbitzeim el hanahar haba el ahava. I gathered them, Ezra says, to the river which comes to Ahava. Ava is a place that Mikra suggests that is east of the Euphrates. Okay. Again, in other words, and they're not yet on the way. They're getting themselves together. So I gathered all of these people. Vanachane sham yamim shlosha. We camped there for 3 days. Va'avina va'am uva'kohanim. I examined the nation and the kohanim. Avina. I worked to understand who's there. Ubibnei Levi lomatzasi sham. But you know what I couldn't find? Couldn't find Levium. And when he says Levium here, he doesn't mean tribe of Levi, because Kohanim are tribe of Levi, but he means the Levium, the guy who gets the second Aliyah. That's what he means. The people who are supposed to do the work of singing, holding the doors, that's Levium. We've talked about them. He says, I can't find them. Uh-oh. V'eshlechala Eliezer la'ariel lishmaya ula elnatan ul'ariv ula elnatan ulnatan v'lizacharya. You did see two elnatans there. V'lemeshulam rashim ul'yoyariv ula elnatan mivinim. So I sent out a message to this roster of people who are the leaders, the rashim of the kohanim, as the Dan Mikra reads this. The El Natan apparently is a common name here. But I sent to the leaders of the Kohanim, as well as to Yoyariv and El Natan Mivinim, meaning people who either understood the nation or people who taught the nation. He says, I sent a message to them saying, I have a problem. We don't have Levium. Well, yeah.
Are you assuming that these are all people gathered in this encampment for 3 days?
Yeah. Correct.
Okay.
Well, even though they're not listed all as heads of the travelers. And I instructed them, Al Ido Harosh, to Ido the head, because Sifya Hamakom, and the place Kasifya, this fellow Ido is in charge. Vasima Bifiem Dvarim, and I gave them words, Ladaber Al Ido, to speak to Ido, Achiv Hanisinim, because Sifya Hamakom, and to his brothers, the Netinim of that place. The Netinim worked for the Beis HaMikdash. So I sent a message through these leaders to the head of the Netinim. Lavi lanu mishar simla beis elokeinu. Bring us people to serve in the Beis HaMikdash, to serve in the temple. We have a Levi shortage. Now, even in the first group, the 42,000 who came originally, there were very few Levium. There were like 120-something Levium in that group. But Ezra says, I don't have any Levium in my group. Why? We have to talk about it. Ve'aviu lanu kiyad alokeinu hatova aleinu ish sechel mibnei machli ben Levi ben Yisrael v'sheirev yaovana ve'achav shmona asar. So they brought us kiyad alokeinu hatova, like the good hand of God. Rashi explains this as saying with God's help. Like in the previous chapter, we also saw a number of appearances of according to the hand of God. This is his way of saying, thank God we got some. We have 18 Levium from the family of Machli ben Levi. Ve'es Chashavya v'ito Yeshaya mibnei Merari. We got some who are descendants of Merari. That's a familiar Levi name. Echav. His brethren, Uvnehem, and their kids, Esrim. 20. So this way, we had some Levium show up as he ordered the Nesinim to gather them. In these psukim that we just read, sentences 15 to 20, what jumps out at you as interesting, besides the fact that the Levi families are no-shows?
Yeah.
Yeah, Julie.
I have a question. And are the Levine notions because Levine happen to not want to come, or there are legitimately no Levine to come?
Right. So we don't know. Maybe there really are no Levine around. Yeah.
Or no Levine suitable to serve.
What do you mean?
You know, story of how some of them, I mean, but of what, when they first got to Babel, didn't some of them make themselves sort of...
Yes.
Unsuitable.
Yes. So we will get to a Gemara that you're talking about, or Medrash that you're talking about, which Rashi quotes, that indeed suggests that some of the Levim actually sabotage themselves.
But that would have been... The question is, would they continue to sabotage themselves? But who is... But where is... Is Ido with them?
So Ido apparently is not. Ido is living in Kasifia. He's not part of this group, but Ezra summons him and says, we need some help. Round up some Levium for me. Mm-hmm. Right.
Is Ido a prophet?
So we have the name Ido as Zechariah, son of Ido, separately. But this Ido seems to be among the Nisinim. Yeah?
With the destruction of the temple and the Levites, the Levites were supposed to be, that was their job, to look after all duties and protection of and everything to do with the temple, military too. Maybe they just didn't have work to do when they were in Babel.
And therefore
kind of just sort of drifted out.
They stopped calling themselves Levi. Right. So that's actually something that we've seen in, you know, more contemporarily, meaning that in our own day, there are many, many more Kohanim around than there are Levim, and it doesn't make any sense. Meaning you walk into a shul, you are far more apt to find Kohanim, and in real numbers, than you are to find Levim. And I think a lot of that is because there was no percentage in identifying yourself as a Levi. You know, Kohen, people had a sense of, that's lineage to be a Kohen. You know, Levi, we're number two. We try harder, maybe. The identity of Levi. I know, any Levi in here before I insult every Levi? Yeah. Okay, so we have one. But that, how many people come from families? How many of you come from families of Kohenim? You see that? It makes no sense genetically, in the sense that, remember the genealogy, right? Levi has three sons, Gershon, Kehaz, and Merari. Kehaz has four sons, Amram, Yitzhar, Chevron, and Uziel. Amram has Moshe, Aharon, Miriam. Aharon is the only one who's going to produce Kohanim in that bunch, right? One of two sons, I'm leaving Miriam out of this because she's going to go end up with a different Shevet, but one out of Moshe Aharon, who are themselves from Amram, who is one of four, and their father is one of three. Everybody else there should be producing Levium. What happened that we end up with the dominance of the Kohanim? And I think really it's a lot better to have your hands washed than to be the washer of other people's hands. I think that's just it was less serious an identity to hold on to. And so I think that's contemporarily what happened. Whether you could backread that into what happens in Babel and say also they didn't hold on. You know, we made a point in chapter 2 when we saw the list of who was from which Shevet, and we said, wow, that's really impressive that they retained tribal identity when they were in Babel. It shows that they felt like we are coming back, but maybe Levi didn't see it that way.
It's true on Sfarim as well.
That what? That the ratio of that?
Yeah, I don't know. When I saw the hands go up, frankly.
No, but it's true in shul. I mean, think about how many people go up to do Birchas Kohanim and how many people are available to wash their hands. You know, it's a known phenomenon. So maybe the answer really is that they didn't retain identity. That's one possible point. They did have Levium in Israel because you did have some from the first group. It's not like you lost them altogether. But that's one possible explanation is that they didn't retain their identity. Mitsudat David quotes you a Rashi in Kiddushin who offers a different answer in source number 4. I'll come back to number 3, but people ask this question, so I'll push this question first of what happened to them. Rashi in Kiddushin quotes you what Rebecca was referring to. Ezra did not find suitable Levim who could do the service. Only those who had bitten off their thumbs. Va'amru, they said, Eich nashir et shir Hashem, right? That from the pasuk in Tehillim, how can we sing the song of God? They present a context for this chapter in Tehillim, which clearly will have to post-date David HaMelech. Whether David HaMelech sings this in Tehillim, and then it's just prophetic, and they end up singing it later, or whether it simply comes from this later time, which is still obviously before the Great Assembly, before the Knesset HaGedolah. But what's the story? Sha'amalam Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar says, Shiru lanu mishir Tzion. Sing the songs of Zion. Right? It's mockery. Right? Which we saw, moving to the current day, we saw in the Holocaust as well, telling the Jews, sing your songs. And they are told, sing your songs. So what did they do? Amdu v'kitzitzu bahonos yideim b'shineim. They bit off their thumbs. They said, we will not play our instruments for you. And again, lest you think like this is a crazy story, we saw stories like this. Of people who refused to sing at the price of their own life for the Germans. So this is what they did. They said, we're not going to play our instruments. And they said, Eich nashir et shir Hashem alad manechar. How are we going to sing on this foreign land? So they didn't say, lo nashir lo nemar. They didn't say, we're not going to sing. Eich nashir, but how can we sing? Ein lanu bameh lemashmish b'nimei akinoros. We have no way to play. We can't play the instruments. We don't have thumbs. Me'osan alu. So from them, and presumably it's not just them, but 70 years later it would have to be their descendants. Not just them. So those are the ones who came back. Umenak Sherim Lomatza, but Ezra did not find anyone who would be able to serve. Lefisha Yoshim Babel Bashalva, because they were sitting in comfort and tranquility in Babel. Va'olim Birushalayim, and those who came back to Yerushalayim, Hayu Ba'oni. They were suffering. Ubetarach hamalacha, they're straining with work. Ubeimas kol svivoseh, and they're afraid of everybody around them. It's a beleaguered group that has come back. And Ezra says, I need somebody who can actually come serve. So that's what Ezra is looking for. According to Rashi in Kiddushin, they didn't have people who could serve, and that's what he is looking for. The Da'at Mikra offers a very interesting third possibility that I have not seen anybody else suggest about what it was that happened with the Levium. And he points you to Psukim in Yechezkel, which I referenced here in source number 5. Take a look, please. It's worth seeing it. Yechezkel chapter 44. If you're using the Stone Tanakh, page 1317. Yechezkel speaks to the Jews who are in exile. And it's sentences 9 to 14. People have it? Ko amar Hashem Elokim, so declares God, Ko ben nechar, any stranger, erel lev ve'erel basar, of uncircumcised heart and uncircumcised flesh. Lo yavo amikdashi, does not get to enter my temple. L'chol ben nechar asher besoch b'nei Yisrael, the estranged ones who are among the Jewish people. He's not talking about people who are somehow biologically, genetically ineligible. He's talking about Jews who have become estranged. Ki malaviyim asher rochaku me'alai bisos Yisrael asher tov me'alai acharei gilulehem. He specifies, he singles out Levium. Those Levium who wandered. When Israel wandered, when they left me to follow the idols, v'nasu avonam, they are going to be punished for their sins. V'ayuba mikdashim misharsim, pikudos al sharei abayit u'misharsim es abayit. He says, they're going to be attendants in the temple. They'll be serving the house. Hema yishchatu es ha'olav es hazevach lo'am. They're going to shecht the offerings, they're going to stand to serve. He says they served the idols. They're going to be a cause for sin among the house of Israel. God says absolutely not. They will suffer for their sins. They don't get to serve. And they will instead be punished and shamed for what they have done. Now, that passage is not Levi specific. It includes Kohanim. Right? It speaks of people doing services that the Kohanim do. But that mikra suggests that that's why they don't come back. You're going to give me mussar like that and then expect me to show up? You tell me that if I strayed and I sinned, I should now come back to the second temple? There's no incentive for me to come home just to get insulted? Just to be told that I'm unworthy? So forget it. That's the Dav Mikra suggestion for why you don't have Levium, is because Yechezkel did too good a job. He intimidated them out of coming back. It's an interesting thought.
How many would have been slaughtered when the Babylonians came and took the temple?
Don't know. It's a good question, but I don't believe we have any record. We just know that there were massacres. So you think maybe that they're lost for that reason?
Part of their job was to guard the gate and defend it.
True. It's an interesting suggestion. I haven't really seen it discussed, but it's an interesting idea as well. So now we have four ideas, right, for why they didn't come back. We have the idea that they didn't retain their identity. We have the idea that they were ineligible because of this disqualification from playing the instruments. We have the idea that they were intimidated by Yechezkel's warnings, or the idea that they were simply not there. They were killed in defending the temple against the Babylonians. All of these, I think, have something to recommend them. Okay. Well, Ezra takes action for this. Ezra is not only going hunting for Levium, but he actually punishes the Levium because of this. He punishes them collectively. Take a look at source number 6 at Gemara and Yevamos. The Hebrew is at the bottom of one side, the English is at the top of the next side. And what we're going to have to figure out is where in the world this Gemara gets this idea from. Because the Gemara is going to say something without supporting it from the text. The Gemara in Yevamos assumes that the Levium were fined, they were punished, and they lost Meiser, meaning, normally when you separate tithes from Israeli produce, your first tithe is the Bikurim, the first fruits, and that's brought to the temple and given to the Kohanim. Then you have the tithe of Truma, and the Truma goes to the Kohanim as well. And then you have a tithe, 10% of what's left, that goes to Levi. That's called Maser Rishon, and it goes to the Levium. Anybody's allowed to eat it. Unlike Truma, which is only eaten by the Kohanim, and there are penalties if a non-Kohen eats the Truma, the Meiser can be eaten by anybody. The Levi can say, I'm throwing a Meiser party. Here's my Meiser, everybody come join me. It's just fine. However, the mitzvah is, give it to the Levi. That's what you're supposed to do. However, by the time you hit the second base HaMikdash, the Gemara assumes, Levium aren't getting the Meiser. Meiser is given to others. Who exactly we'll see in this passage? But it's assumed that this is a penalty for the Levium. And the Gemara wants to know, why did you take away Meiser from Levi?
And we know that they took it away from what text?
Well, that's what we have to figure out, is where did they get this idea from? Right, how do you know that it's taken away from them, and how do you know that Ezra's the one who took it away from them? We have to talk about. But the Gemara takes it as a given that there is a punishment of Levi. They don't get their they don't have a claim to the Maaser. They can eat it like anybody can eat it, but they don't have a claim to it. Boy, you're getting hit on the head today, David. I'm sorry.
There's a tradition in Djerba,
in Tunisia. Yeah,
that Djerba was a island
of Kohanim,
Tunisia.
No?
Kohanim and Levium in the first temple.
Yeah.
And I don't know the source from this, to tell you the truth, but there was a request, and maybe this is part of it, that they return. Mm-hmm. And that they sent, my understanding was they sent Kohanim from Djerba, who were ritually pure Kohanim. They stayed only marrying within their own tribe, etc. and that they refused. They said the temple is not proper. It's not kosher. Mm-hmm. And that they were cursed. And the curse, this is hard for Levim, because the Kohanim said it was impure, was the Levim were wiped out. There's a plague. And then the Kohanim, in reverse, cursed the people who cursed them, which I think was Ezra or Nehemiah, in letters, and predicted to the year the date that the second temple would be destroyed.
This I don't know anything about.
They wanted to go back, and not everybody felt the temple was kosher.
It's a fascinating story. I would love to see something in terms of where this is written up. Yeah, I knew about Jerba claiming the, to be Kohanim. I didn't know anything about the rest of the
originally
the story.
It was Kohanim and Levim.
Okay.
And then the Levim got wiped out right around this time in history, apparently, in Jerba.
Okay, so at this point, we have problem upon problem for Kohanim and Levim in the beginning of the Second Temple. Okay, I feel bad for them. The source number six, Mipnei Ma Kunza Levim Meister. So why did they take away Meister from Levim? Pligi Bo Rav Yonasan Visavaya. Rav Yonasan and the elders debated this. Chad Omar, one said, Shalo Alu Bimei Ezra, because they didn't come back in Ezra's time, therefore they lost Meister. They lost the tithe. The Chad Omar, and the other said, no, it wasn't a punishment for them. It was Kadesh Yismuchu Kohanim Allah be made to my son. It was actually given to the Kohanim. And the point was, you're not allowed to eat Truma if you are ritually impure. So what are the Kohanim supposed to eat? They're broke. They don't have any land. What are they going to eat? So therefore, it was an attempt to support the Kohanim by giving them the Meister of the Levium.
Who's supporting the Levium?
Well, the argument would go that that Meister is 10% of your produce, so there's a lot there, there's enough to go around. If it could support Levi, it could also support Kohanim who are impure. To which the Gemara says, well, wait a minute. Bishlam alamandamar shalo alu, mishamachi kansinu. If you take the first view, I understand. They didn't come back? So Ezra says, ha, you lose the Meister. That I get. But if it's for the sake of supporting the Kohanim, Mishum Kohanim Kansinu Levim, Levim have to suffer. Create a new tithe. Right? Make some other new gift to Kohanim support fund.
It's also not a new phenomenon, the Kohanim are tame at some times.
Right. That's another point, right? I mean, this could have been made 500 years earlier. Why did you do this now? Ella, rather, Kule Alma Knasa Shalom Alu Bimei Ezra. So we drop the idea that it's a support fund for the Kohanim. That's not what this is. It is, in fact, a penalty for Levi because they didn't come back in Ezra's time. V'acha b'ha k'miflugi, and this is the debate. Mar Savar Knasa La'aniyim. One view says that it was a fine for the, it was a fine that was then given to paupers in general. Umar Savar Kohanim Bimei Tumasan Aniyim Ninu. And the other one said, no, it didn't mean paupers in general. It was the Kohanim when they are impure, because at that point they're paupers, because they don't have the means of survival. But in other words, what's happening is this Gemara takes as a given that the Levium will lose Meiser, and there's a debate, and sorry, they lose Meiser, and that it's because they didn't come back. And there's a debate as to the distribution of it, because one view said it was for the paupers, and the other view said it was for the Kohanim when they are unable to eat Truma. Those are the views. I actually realize I have a spare sheet here if anyone wants one. I held on to one by accident. You want to pass this down to Dahlia, please? Thank you. Shana, what were you going to say?
Just that in terms of who needs to support more, the Levium, even though they're technically not landholders, they did have cities. And they were part of the economy in a way that the Kohanim were not.
Right. So the argument would go, Levium don't need it as much as the Kohanim. That's a fair point. So Tosfos on this Gemara says, this is all really interesting, but why are we making any connection whatsoever to Ezra? Like, where did you get the idea that this came from Ezra? All we've seen in the Psukim, all we see in the sentence here is, Ezra says, hey, there are no Levium. Do something about it. Bring me Levium. And they bring him some Levium, and they go on. Where do we see anything else in this? So Tosfos offers me two sources. One is Nehemiah 10:39. So if you're using the stone Tanakh, you want page 1863. This is a very difficult sentence to translate. V'haya ha-kohen ben Aharon im ha-leviyim ba'aser ha-leviyim v'ha-leviyim ya'alu es ma'aser ha-ma'aser leveis elokeinu el ha-leshachos leveis ha-otzar. Reading the Art Scroll translation. A Kohen, descendant of Aharon, will be with the Levim at the time of the tithing, which on a simple level I would take to mean when they receive their tithes. And the Levim will bring a tithe of the tithe to the temple, to the storage house, and that's ultimately going to go, it appears, to the Kohanim. Now, we know that the Torah states that the Levim have an obligation. When they receive their Maaser, they have to give one-tenth of that to the Kohanim. It's called Trumas Maaser. That's a rule. That's an old biblical rule. It goes back to the rebellion of Korach. There is a tithe they have to give. So I could read this sentence and say there's nothing untoward going on here. Right? The Levim are receiving their tithe, and they're giving 10% of it to the house of God, meaning to the Kohanim. But the way that Tosfos reads it, he says maybe what you could read here is that what it's saying is that the Levim are actually giving their tithe to the Kohanim. Not one-tenth of their tithe, but they're giving their tithe to the Kohanim. So that the instruction is taking place here in chapter 10 in Nehemiah, under the authority of Ezra, that the Levim are going to give their tithe to the Kohanim. That's a possibility. A Kohen is present and the Levim shall give their tithe to the Kohanim. That's one source.
You mean voluntarily?
Voluntarily. Well, voluntarily because they've been told to.
Oh.
If they're being volunteered to do this. Yeah, and that would be the simple read of the sentence. Tosos is struggling. He's trying to find something. Yeah, the simple read of this sentence does not support the idea that they're giving their entire tithe away. It's simply a Kohen is present and the Levim will give him Trumas Maaser and that's it. That would be the simple read. The other source he points to is Malachi. So you have to go back in Tanakh to the end of Navi in order to find this one. I gave you the reference on the sheet. You can see the verse number there in source number 7. But this is the end of Treyasar. It is page 1433 if you're using the stone Tanakh. This is a classic sentence for a completely different reason. This is the sentence in which Malachi says to the Jews, test God with your tithes. See if he doesn't reward you for tithing. We're told normally you're not allowed to test God. Testing God is a bad idea. But here we're told you could. But the statement is, Haviu es kol ha-maaser el beis ha-otzar. Bring all of the tithes, not a tenth of them, to the Beit Ha'otzar, to the storage house. So you could read this as saying, bring tithes not to the Levim, but to the storage house, meaning to the temple, to the Beis HaMikdash, for the Kohanim, because it says, there will be food, Biveiti, in my house, capital M. Right? This is God saying, then there will be food for the Kohanim. So Malachi is saying, bring the food, bring your tithe, to the Kohanim in my storage house. And keep in mind the Medrash which we discussed way back when, that Ezra and Malachi are the same person. Because remember, Malachi is a prophet in the period of Ezra, right? He's after Haggai and Zechariah. We don't know his name. Malachi is not necessarily his name. Malachi can just as easily mean my messenger. You're in Malachi anyway. Go back to the beginning of the book and tell me where you see his name. Right? It says, Masadra Hashem al Yisrael biyad Malachi, but with the other Nevi'im, we tend to get so-and-so, son of so-and-so. And here you don't. And so the suggestion is, biyad Malachi means in the hand of my messenger, because God speaks in the first person. If you look at the next sentence, he says, I loved you. Right? It's God speaking, so that Malachi could be my messenger, in which case we don't have a name. Well, who would be around in that time, in this next generation of the Second Temple, who could give a message like this? Ezra. And there are other reasons why. We're going to see later on that one of the focuses of Ezra is the intermarriage of the Jews with the nations around them. That's also a major focus of Malachi in his second chapter, where he talks about how they marry the nations among them. That doesn't have to mean they're the same person, right? There are two different figures operating in the land at the same time, facing the same problem. It doesn't have to mean Malachi equals Ezra. But Tosfos is reaching because he wants to know, where do you have any basis for saying, as the Gemara just does, you know, the Gemara doesn't even feel need to support it, to say that they lost their tithe in the days of Ezra. So he's offered you two different psukim, neither of which is a great source, but we need to have some basis for why the Gemara says this. The Gemara is making this assumption from something. So that's what he comes up with. One last note, because I see that we're running out of time here. But I brought you in on your sheet. Go back to source number 3. This was also interesting. No one really picked up on it here when I asked you any questions. Esther says, "I gathered them all to this place, and then we waited for 3 days." Why'd you wait for 3 days? Yeah, we always wait for 3 days. 3 days before the Akedah, 3 days before High Sinai, 3 days, 3 days before Esther goes to Achashverosh. We like 3-day waiting periods. We have this notion of 3 days for a transition, and the truth of the matter is it comes up all through Tanakh. I've discussed it in other Shiurim. 3 days for Yonah and the fish, right? We have this idea of 3-day transition periods in general as a theme in Tanakh. 3 days. Akbala, right? The 3 days before the Torah is given, 3 days before we get to the Yamsuf. Like, there are a lot of 3-day periods, and you can read it that way.
3 days before the
Yard Sedar. 3 days before the Yard. Oh, you mean he's waiting 3 days because he wants to get to that? No, his initial gathering is the 1st of Nisan. This is the 12th of Nisan that he's waiting for at this point. And you could simply say he's waiting 3 days because he wants to see who's going to show up. You know, especially knowing there are no Levim, so he's waiting 3 days. Let's see who gets there. But the Gemara in Erevin, source number 3, uses this as an association for a rule that they practiced in the days of the Gemara that we don't practice today. Rabbi Elazar says, "Habamin aderech al yispalo shlosha yamim." When you come in off the road from a journey, wait 3 days before davening Shmona Esrei. And he gives you this source here, because Ezra is going to recite a prayer, so he waits 3 days after he's gathered everybody before he does it, because he's brought everybody from around Bavel to gather in this place. He wants to wait 3 days. You don't have proper concentration when you come back off of the road. You take a long trip. People today drive by car. They don't know what it means. Even jet lag. You're riding on a horse or a donkey or whatever it is from around Bavel to gather in this place. You can't possibly concentrate properly on prayer at that point. The reason why we've dropped this is simply because people would never daven. Oh, I can't concentrate right now. Sorry, Rabbi. It wouldn't work. So therefore, we just say, you know what? Daven and do your best. But in the days of the Gemara, that was it. And they associate it with Ezra and this 3-day waiting period before he's going to recite the prayer, which we're going to see next. So what we've seen then today is the bulk of chapter 8. We saw the name list, which has meaning in their day, perhaps from a genealogical perspective. Oh, let's make sure everyone knows who they can marry and where they're from. But has greater overtones through the generations in terms of establishing the identity of these great leading families, in terms of stressing the value of the people over the value of Ezra per se, the different explanations that we gave then. And then we find out that we have a problem because there are no Levium, and he has to summon the Netinim and tell them, go bring me Levium, and he gets some Levium. And maybe they're not there because they're embarrassed and afraid, because of Yechezkel's criticism. Maybe they're not there because they made themselves ineligible to serve, or they are there, but they're ineligible to serve, and therefore they're not much use for Ezra. Maybe they didn't retain their identity. Sorry?
Why are they ineligible?
The people who have cut off their thumbs. They can't play the instruments.
If you have a...
Oh, no, not as a mum, but physically you can't play the instruments. Yeah. The mum is not the problem, but they can hold the doors, I guess. They have 8 fingers left. They could sing. That's kind of gruesome. Maybe it's because they didn't retain their identity. That could be. And maybe it's because they were killed by the Babylonians in defense of the Beis HaMikdash. But the bottom line is that they are not there, and Ezra goes looking for replacements, and he also finds the Levium as a tribe according to this Gemara, saying, you're not going to be entitled to Meiser, and we saw two hints for it, one in this Pasuk, which we're going to get to again, God willing, in Nehemiah, in Herav Yameinu, and the other in the Pasuk in Malachi, taking the view that Ezra is Malachi. So we'll pick up with this, God willing, next week, as Ezra recites his prayer, and they get ready to actually make the move to return to the land. Thank you very much.